Hello, it is Wednesday, June 10th. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. The student councils of 18 universities across the nation have denounced the shortage of ballots that occurred during the June 3rd local elections and called for remediations. More on that on today's news briefing. In our in-depth news analysis segment, we'll discuss the ballot shortage incident, how it affects Korea's democracy, and what needs to be done to avoid a repeat of the episode. Plus, writer and book critic John A. Reilly will be joining us on this week's Korea Book Club segment to talk about a science fiction short story collection. Korea 24 starts now. In declarations issued Wednesday, the student councils of 18 universities across the nation condemned the ballot shortages that occurred during last Wednesday's local elections and demanded remediation. Our KBS World Radio's news reporter, Pae Ju-yeon, joins us in the studio to give us the latest on this story and other headlines of the day. Hello, Ju-yeon.
Hello, Andrew.
What did the students say about the ballot shortage situation?
The student council said that the people's right to vote guaranteed by the constitution was violated by a state agency and called for a parliamentary inspection and a special investigation into the ballot shortages while demanding punishment for those responsible. They also demanded remediation for the violation of their basic rights as well as the structural reform of the National Election Commission.
Are there any other particular points that some universities emphasized?
The Yonsei University Student Council declared the incident a moment in which the most fundamental rights of the people have been halted by the incompetence and irresponsibility of state institutions. They also stressed that the issue transcends political camps, saying that it is not about which side benefited, it is about the people's rights, the constitution, and whether Korea can remain a democratic republic. Meanwhile, the Korea University Student Council condemned the National Election Commission's mismanagement for creating an undemocratic situation in which the right to vote cannot be equally guaranteed, arguing the problem goes beyond the NEC's resignation.
In related news, a box considered to be a major piece of evidence related to the ballot shortages that occurred during last Wednesday's local elections is apparently missing. This box was ordered just yesterday by a Seoul court to be preserved as evidence, right?
Yes, that is correct. On Wednesday, Judge Kim Ji-yeon of the Seoul Eastern District Court visited a voting center in Jamsil in Seoul's Songpo District and attempted to secure the box, which had been used to store unmarked ballots before voting started. The visit came a day after the judge ordered the box to be preserved as evidence, accepting some but not all of the requests submitted by the Reform Party's Supreme Council member Kim Jong-chol, who ran for mayor of the Seoul last week.
Has there been any comment from the National Election Commission on this box?
An official from the commission told KBS that the election watchdog picked up the box and is now trying to locate it. In a photograph taken Friday, a box delivered to be the one the judge was looking for had a label marked 1,900 ballots, which is enough for 49.3% of all eligible voters in the district. The election watchdog's rules stipulate that each polling station must have enough ballots for at least 50% of all eligible voters.
Meanwhile, a demonstration in front of a ballot counting center in Jamsil in Seoul's Songpa district protesting the ballot shortages is nearing a week now. Is that correct?
Yes, the demonstration entered its sixth day on Wednesday. Protesters are continuously blocking entrance to the SK Olympic Handball Gymnasium, which was designated county center in the district, disrupting the activities of sports organizations that use the gym. The protesters claim ballot shortages violated their constitutional rights and are demanding a revote, with some also demanding that ballots be counted by hand.
In other news, President Lee Jae-myung has met with Belgian Prime Minister Bart De Wever for summit talks. Ju-yeon, what did they talk about?
At the meeting in Brussels on Wednesday, the two leaders shared views on ways to expand bilateral trade relations and boost cooperation between small and mid-sized companies. They also discussed ways to strengthen cooperation between educational institutions in both countries and promote future generation exchanges, all in a bid to expand the basis for Korean studies education in Europe. Wednesday marked the first South Korea-Belgium summit since the launch of the Lee Jae-myung administration. He is also scheduled to meet King Philip of Belgium on Wednesday.
The government has decided to dissolve the Army's Defense Counterintelligence Command after 49 years. This is because it played a key role in former President Yoon Suk-yeol's martial law action in late 2024. Is this right?
Yes, that is right. Defense Minister An Kyu-bak announced on Wednesday that the command's anti-espionage, security inspection, and investigation duties will be delegated to other organizations. The anti-espionage and defense industry intelligence, as well as cybersecurity functions, will be taken by a new agency, tentatively named the Defense Counter-Espionage Headquarters. The investigatory duties and authority over a combined investigation under martial law will be transferred to the Defense Ministry's Criminal Investigation Command, while the security inspection function would be sent to another new body, tentatively named the Defense Security Support Team. Take note that the command's function to collect various personal info would be abolished to prevent any organization from wielding absolute power within the military.
Let's turn now to politics. The main opposition People Power Party has elected a new floor leader. Chiyun, give us the details, please.
Three-term Representative Chung Jeom-sik was elected to the top party post during a General Assembly of Party lawmakers on Wednesday. Chung won 55 votes in a runoff against four-term Representative Kim Do-up, who secured 48 votes. The runoff came after a first round of voting in which none of the three candidates obtained a majority.
And what did the new floor leader, Chung Jeom-sik, have to say about his election?
He said he would engrave deep in his heart the heavy and important responsibility his fellow representatives had entrusted to him, that of rebuilding the party and regaining the public's confidence. Chung, who was backed by the party's mainstream and was once close to ousted President Yoon Suk-yeol, promised to fulfill his duties free of any influence from specific figures or factions.
In other headlines, President Lee Jae-myung has told The Economist in an interview that he believes that North Korea will be even less inclined to give up its nuclear arsenal following the war in Iran. What are some of the other highlights of Lee's comments to the British Journal?
According to its interview of Lee published online on Wednesday, The Economist also said that Lee, in keeping with Democratic Party tradition, has made every effort to reach out to North Korea. But the reclusive state, which in recent years has taken to calling South Korea a hostile state and is now enjoying the fruits of a new alliance with Russia, has shown no interest in talking to the South. It then quoted Lee as saying U.S. President Donald Trump's unique personality can be very helpful in the current situation, without further elaboration.
For our final story, Seoul city officials have urged citizens to use public transportation ahead of crowds expected to gather in downtown Seoul for South Korea's first match at the FIFA World Cup on Friday. Chiyun, give us the details, please.
The Seoul Metropolitan Government said Wednesday that it expects many people to gather in Gwanghwamun Square on Friday when Team Korea's first match of the FIFA World Cup will be held at 11 a.m. against Czechia. The city government said people who work in the affected area should prepare for heavy congestion and plan ahead. In addition, hot weather is expected. Authorities are recommending that people who attend drink plenty of water and minimize sun exposure as much as possible. Emergency medical support systems and heat wave measures will be in place while safety management personnel are deployed on the streets around the event venue.
And that's it for today's news briefing. Thank you, Jian.
Thanks, Andrew.
The National Election Commission is at the center of controversy after unprecedented ballot shortages in the local elections last week. According to the NEC, 91 voting centers ran out of ballot papers on June 3rd, and as a result, voting was temporarily halted at 26 polling stations nationwide, 15 of which were in Seoul's Songpa district. The ballot shortages have sparked public outcry, with protesters gathering outside a ballot counting center in Seoul's Songpa district for the sixth day today. To get to the bottom of the matter, a joint prosecution police investigation is expected to be launched possibly this week. To take a deep dive into these issues, we are joined on the line by two guests. First, we have law professor Kim Gi-chang from Korea University. Hello, Professor Kim.
Hello.
We also have Professor Park Bum-suk from the Department of Political Science and International Relations from Chungang University. Hello, Professor Park.
Hello.
So, to our first question, we go to Professor Park. Ballot papers ran short at some voting centers in Seoul's Songpa, Gangnam, and Gwangjin districts, where voters were forced to wait in long lines and cast their ballots after the official voting deadline. Voting hours were extended by 4 hours to 10 p.m. At the affected sites. But how does the shortage of ballot papers compromise election fairness?
I think we need to separate two different questions, though. I think the first question is whether this incident changed the final outcome of the elections. And at this point, I would be very cautious about making the claim. So what we can say that, though, this appears to be very serious administrative failure or human errors by the NEC, but not necessarily the evidence of intentional manipulations or election fraud. But the second question is whether this incident damaged the fairness or integrity of elections process. And here, I think the answer is clearly yes. Because the election fairness is not only about the, you know, final vote count, it is also about whether, you know, every eligible voters has like a reasonable and equal opportunity to cast a ballot under the normal conditions. In this case, you know, some voters had to wait in a long queue. Some may have to leave due to the other commitment, health issues, or simply could not wait for like several more hours, right? So that means some problem may have discouraged or prevented some people, like, you know, exercising their constitutional right to vote. And there is also another serious issues, like, let's say, like an information inequality. So in some affected polling stations, right, voting continued after the official deadline, which is 6 p.m., then some voters may have been exposed to the exit poll before they cast their ballot. So this is problematic because, you know, voters who cast the ballot later may have had information that the earlier voters did not have. So even if the number of such a voter was small, but this violates the basic principle that the voters should make their vote choices under the broadly equal information conditions.
Some of those elements are certainly behind the public frustrations that are being expressed partly at the Songpa district that we just mentioned. But Professor Kim, you're a legal scholar. How did you interpret the same incident, and what effect does it have on Korea's democracy?
I think before talking about law, this is an absurd incompetence, mind-boggling error, human error, systematic error of National Election Commission. In my view, there is no excuse whatsoever. But for listeners who know nothing about Korean voting system at the moment, we do have early voting, somewhat similar to absentee ballot casting. But all across the bipartisan or opposition and ruling parties, they all, their official position is that we would like to encourage early voting or whichever way suits you. So we do have 2 days of early voting, and then there is main voting on the day of the election. So many people did cast their ballots in one of these 2 days where you can go to any of the polling stations. It doesn't have to be your designated polling station for these 2 days of early voting. Whereas on the main day of voting, you have to go to your domicile voting polling station. So many people did cast votes during early voting, 2 days opportunity. And the election, National Election Commission simply didn't accurately calculate how much they should print out the voting paper for the main day of voting. Now, there is, this is unacceptable because they do have records who voted. And then there must be, you know, enough technology to accurately count how many papers they have to be ready. But then they didn't, or they obviously failed to even give a reasonable estimate for this. But then there is another issue, because some of the opposition, some of the extreme opposition, I don't think it's the People Party, but some kind of fringe segment of the opposition, they have this firm conviction that the ruling party is committing election fraud and nothing can change their conviction. And they advocated that you should never vote during the early voting days. They insisted that you have to vote on the day of the election day, which is the 3rd of June this time. And in the Songpa area, it seems that there is relatively more people who chose to vote on the election day itself. Mm. And that was a serious shortage of ballot paper in Songpa area. So about the democracy, I don't think anybody doubts that this is just unacceptable. You know, National Election Commission not having enough ballot paper printed. I mean, this is just outrageous. But to link this to any allegation of election fraud, in my view, is groundless, simply groundless. But then luckily, this time for Seoul mayoral election, it was the opposition party candidate, Mr. Oh, who ultimately got elected. And that, in my view, ironically, it's a good news because it's the opposition who largely sympathized with election fraud argument. Let's imagine if the ruling party candidate had been elected and there was serious ballot paper shortage in Songpa, especially that area is where opposition is very strong. Now this election fraud allegation would have gathered enormous energy, and that would be really disastrous for Korean democratic process.
So Professor Kim touched on all the frustrations, and wherever, regardless of where you stand on the political spectrum, the shortage of ballot papers is something that should be frowned upon. Professor Kim, we go to you again. The two main parties, which I guess reflect the bipartisan frustration behind this, the two main parties each submitted a request Monday for parliamentary investigation into this shortage. Both parties are calling for a thorough probe into the causes of the shortage, and there were subtle differences, however, from each party, especially regarding the proposed investigation scope. Professor Kim might have touched on this just before this, but beyond calling for an investigation, the conservative main opposition, People Power Party leader Chang Dong-hyuk, is also demanding that the National Election Commission declare the June 3rd elections null and void and to hold nationwide elections again. Legally, Professor Kim, what would trigger a redo of last week's nationwide elections? What are the requirements for such a trigger to occur? And do you think a redo is necessary in this case? And how feasible is it to do a redo of the nationwide election?
Okay, there are two separate issues. One is probe, parliamentary probe. Yes, they should go ahead. And in my view, on top of it, and in addition to that, there must be police investigation. I think it's criminal negligence, and National Election Commission must be held accountable, and they should be sanctioned in a most appropriate manner. So that is probe and criminal investigation, and that must be done. And even President Lee Jae-myung emphasized that there must be criminal investigation. Now, about the re-election, it is somewhat curious that the opposition leader is advocating re-election because their candidate, Mr. Oh, got elected in Seoul area. And in some other key areas, like Pyeongtaek or in Busan, in Pyeongtaek, their party candidate got elected. And in Busan, in some of the high-profile election contests, the opposition candidate got elected, but the opposition leader is now demanding re-election. That seems to be somewhat confusing. Mm. But as far as legal process is concerned, what opposition leader is demanding is not recognized. There is a recognized process of re-election, which is opposition party or the party or the candidate or any of the voters may file petition to the National Election Commission. And National Election Commission determines whether this particular election needs to be declared null in its entirety or whether voting in a particular voting district, such as Songpa, should be declared null. So either entire election for the mayoral or some election could be declared null, or the partial voting district result may be declared null. But if National Election Commission decides that it should not, it should be okay, the overall outcome is not affected by this incident, then they might rule that there is no problem with the election. But you can appeal from NEC's determination to Supreme Court or the appellate court, and then the court will ultimately determine whether to hold re-election or not. So there are these existing procedure and process, and I think the opposition leader, Mr. Zhang, is just ignoring this existing process, and then he's just calling for re-election, which in my view is just a political stunt, and which in my view is not even persuasive within the opposition party itself, because the mayor-elect, Mr. Oh, is saying that there should be no re-election.
So, to some, there are methods to do this if we have to, but Chang Dong-hyuk's calls appear to be political posturing. Professor Park, what are your views regarding the necessity of whether or not to do this again, and if we do this again, how feasible doing this again would be, you know, good?
So the feasibility of the re-elections, I mean, nationwide re-elections by definition would mean that, like, invalidating the June the 3rd local election outcome, right, as a whole, and holding them again across the country. And that is, like, you know, extraordinary remedy, but not a routine political option. So at this point, I do not think nationwide re-elections are necessary. I mean, the ballot shortage was a serious, like, administrative failure and a serious, like, infringement of voting rights in affected polling stations. But there is a difference between saying that there was a serious failure and saying that the entire election must be invalidated. So to justify the nationwide re-elections, I think one would need stronger evidence that the irregularity were, like, systematic and widespread, and it was serious enough to affect the overall outcome. But so far, the incident appears serious but relatively localized. I mean, the NEC reported that, I mean, the ballot shortage was around, like, 50 out of more than 14,000 polling stations nationwide. And with temporary suspensions, about 22, you know, stations, locations. I mean, that is unacceptable, like Professor Kim already mentioned, but this does not automatically justify the cancellation of the whole re-elections. But interestingly, I mean, similar to Professor Kim's point of view, I mean, the demand is also, I mean, politically, the demand is also very complicated, because the PPP, I mean, especially the leader of the PPP, is calling for the re-elections or election invalid. But the Seoul mayor, Oh Se-hu, is one of the PPP's most important winners, was re-elected in the same election. So a nationwide re-election demand would also put the legitimacy of the PPP's own symbolic victory in Seoul into question, which is contradictions, right? So I would say, like, investigations, accountability, or reforms are necessary or absolutely necessary. But the nationwide re-elections would be legally and practically very, very difficult unless new evidence shows that the ballot shortage changed the outcome of the elections or fundamentally compromised the election as a whole.
So we can feel the heat from both experts today. But building on Professor Park's point about re-election, putting in jeopardy the victories that the opposition has been able to obtain. Professor Kim, we go to you again. Why do you think the People Power Party leader Chang Dong-hyuk is calling for this nationwide redo? And does that have anything to do with the fact that his party lost pretty badly?
I think there are two reasons. One is that the opposition People's Party is in fact relying on this ultra kind of some extreme segment who have strenuously argued that the ruling party has been committing election fraud. So the People's Party and its leader, Mr. Zhang, cannot really distance themselves from this extreme segment who has been, you know, repeating election fraud. They even adopted the Stop the Steal kind of slogan. They wave U.S. flags, and some of them even wave Israeli flags. I don't think they understand what it means to wave Israeli flags these days, but they held firm conviction that this country is going down the drain because of election fraud. Now, the ruling party, Mr. Zhang, cannot really distance himself, or his party cannot really distance themselves from this extreme segment. That, in my view, is unfortunate. Now, second reason why Mr. Zhang is calling for re-election is perhaps there is some internal power struggle within the opposition party. In fact, they don't really like Mr. Oh to be the next presidential candidate. They want to somehow, you know, deal some heavy blow against Mr. Oh. Maybe they thought that Mr. Oh was not going to be elected, but, you know, for some whatever reason, Mr. Oh got elected. They want to kind of redo everything. That, in my view, is not going to bode well for the opposition party. People are puzzled. Why are they doing this outrageous, unreasonable demand? Their own party's candidate got the most important election, and their party leader is calling for re-election. That is not going to be a good sale, I think.
So, to sum, the inability of Zhang Donghyuk, according to Professor Kim, to extricate himself from the more farther right elements of the party and his suspected dislike of Oh Se-hoon could be motivating him to do this. We go to Professor Park. President Lee Jae-myung has ordered the launch of a joint investigation by prosecutors and police on the ballot shortages that disrupted last week's local elections. The joint investigation could be launched as soon as this week. Meanwhile, the police have been investigating on their own, summoning the National Election Commission or members of that commission. And how optimistic are you, Professor Park, about the probe by the joint investigation team? Do you think that we'll get to the bottom of the matter?
I think my answer is going to be short about these questions. I mean, and at the same time, you know, cautiously optimistic, but only limited to extent. So the investigation will probably identify the immediate, like, logistic failure, who made the wrong estimates, or why ballot paper were not prepared in sufficient numbers, and how the NEC responded on election day in what ways. But I think getting to the deeper problem is harder. The key question is whether this was simply poor logistics or institutional complacencies or something more systematic. So, I mean, and going back to your question about the public trust to be restored, I think the investigation must be very, very independent and transparent and specific. And it should not end with a few officers taking responsibility.
There have been similar cases of ballot paper shortages in other countries. Can you tell us about those cases, Professor Park, and what lessons Korea can draw from those cases?
Yeah. Interestingly, though, the case, like multiple cases abroad, was very recent one as well. I mean, one important case was in Berlin 2021, I guess, and multiple elections were held on the same day, and some polling stations experienced the ballot shortage, and more importantly, wrong ballot deliveries and long lines and voting even after the exit polls, similar things, you know, similar thing that we just experienced in South Korea. But Germany did not hold a full-scale nationwide re-elections. Instead, it held partial re-elections only in the affected district. And another example is in Queensland, Australia, in 2024, the elections management body underestimated voter turnout. I mean, again, there's similar things that was happening here in South Korea, and some polling stations ran short of, you know, ballot paper. But Australia, in this case, did not respond with the full re-elections. The focus was more about the logistic reforms, better forecasting for turnout, and stronger oversight. So, you know, the lessons for Korea is clear, I guess. The Bali problem was serious, but the response should be evidence-based and proportionate. So Korea should investigate what went wrong, protect voters' rights, and reform ballot allocation procedures. But again, unless there is clear evidence that the problem changed the election outcome, a full-scale or full nationwide re-election would be too drastic.
Professor Kim, we go to you for our final question. What needs to be done to prevent similar incidents that has happened not only in Korea, but also Australia and Germany, as Professor Park has nicely explained to us? What needs to be done to prevent these incidents from happening in the future?
Well, first of all, the National Election Commission should be held more accountable, and their organization and method of working should be more transparent. In Korea, the National Election Commission has been in a very secluded, protected environment. Their operation has been opaque, and they were not really held accountable for many, many decades. And this time it blew up big time. And secondly, I think the problem should be resolvable and remediable relatively easily, given the technology. And the Korean government, not the government, the election commission has all the data they need. Who turned up, how many people, you know, who voted, and how many papers they need. So it's not a rocket science, and it's just a matter of incompetence and accumulated kind of bad practice, simply because this organization, National Election Commission, has been under the leadership of judges who did not really have a hands-on approach to the election oversight, because it was some sort of honorary title, and judges just automatically were given the title of chairman of the election commission, and they don't really, you know, think that this is a serious task. They relied on their subordinates' work, and that kind of terrible management this time blew up big time. And now I think we have to seriously redesign the organization of National Election Commission.
So today's conclusion ends with Professor Kim's remarks that the fix will not be rocket science. Perhaps that is good news. But that's all for today's in-depth news analysis. Joining us today was Law Professor Kim Gi-chang from the Korea University's Law School. Thank you, Professor Kim.
And thank you, Professor Park.
And also Professor Park Bum-suk from the Department of Political Science and International Relations from Chung-Ang University. Thank you to you too, Professor Park.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index dipped 366.11 points, or 4.52%, on Wednesday, to close at 7,730.82. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 16.18 points, or 1.67%, to close at 951.63. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Andrew.
So, what's our first story today?
A TOEIC is a test of English language proficiency that's commonly taken here in the nation, a standardized English proficiency test designed primarily for non-native speakers. Mm. Two sections, listening and reading, both consisting of multiple choice questions. And two people taking this exam have been gaining attention mainly because their method stood out when they got caught cheating. They were different from conventional approaches. They utilized AI glasses.
So cheating is something we talk about every now and then on Korea Trending. And with the advent of AI, cheating is something that will evolve with it. But AI glasses is something new to me. Is this the first time that we're seeing this type of cheating?
Now, the Korea TOEIC Committee said on Wednesday that this is the first recorded case of TOEIC exam takers using AI glasses to cheat in Korea. The two were caught after proctors of two exams, one on May 10th and the other on the 31st, reported suspicions the test takers were wearing AI glasses.
Again, cheating is something we should try to stamp out, obviously, but don't do it in the first place would be my take. What are the penalties for getting caught cheating on TOEIC?
So in accordance with committee regulations, the duo's test results are invalidated, and they're also slapped with a 4-year ban from taking the TOEIC test.
I can imagine people howling about how that's a slap on the wrist, but how do the glasses actually help the test takers cheat?
The AI glasses combine cameras and microphones with generative AI. The device can analyze captured images, related information through lenses or built-in speakers. Because some of the latest models appear not that different from regular spectacles, it can really blend in and make it hard to tell the AI tool is whether it's different from regular glasses.
Kudos to the proctors who caught those cheaters in the act. What kind of response measures are education authorities implementing to prevent recurrence of cheating using these types of gadgets?
So recently, exam proctors have been receiving new training to help them effectively, efficiently detect AI glasses worn during tests. And reportedly, there are plans to ensure such devices are banned in test centers during the all-important Suning or Nationwide College Entrance Exam in Korea.
Hoping that our proctors can be given the tools to do that, we go now to our second story. Dan, what do you have for us?
Omakase restaurants have been enjoying explosive popularity in Korea in early 2020s, but we're seeing a drastic turn in recent years.
A drastic turn for the worse, I presume. But first, can you give us a brief introduction of omakase and what this dining culture or system is?
So the word translates into "I'll leave it up to you." Chefs choose from what the market offers and dictate an entire multi-course tasting menu to provide a highly personalized dining experience. So it is the reverse or the opposite of a la carte, where customers choose from what the kitchen has prepared to serve. It's very high-end dining experience, easily costing around 250,000 won or about $160 per meal.
So perhaps the price might have something to do with this. How drastic of a decline in omakase's popularity are we talking about?
According to Naver Data Lab figures released Sunday, the search volume for omakase has fallen to 15 last month after marking continued decline since peaking to 100 in January of 2023. First time in about 3 years, the volume dipped over 85%, diving down to even lower than pre-COVID-19 levels. A major reservation platform showed an omakase restaurant, which topped the list for 2 years between 2023 and 2024, has been pushed out of the rankings last year. Growing number of business closures are also evidence. A Ministry of Security and Public Administration data shows more than 2,500 Japanese restaurants, which includes those providing omakase services, were closed between 2023 and May this year.
So a steep decline being reflected in the data. What is driving more and more consumers away from this particular type of fine dining experience?
Some industry experts point to, as you earlier mentioned, continued inflation and weak consumption. According to the National Statistical Portal COSIS, the consumer price index last month spiked more than 3% on year to surpass 119, a huge leap compared to 100 back in 2020. Just a few years back, omakase became super popular, especially among those in their 20s and 30s, in tune with the growing culture of breaking bank to mark special days like anniversaries or major holidays, not to mention social media flaunting. But as the price burden of eating out increases, demand for more affordable options like office or school cafeteria or budget buffets increase. The notion of extravagant dining experience has been adjusted for inflation. More people opt for budget or low-end buffet chains that charges only between 10 to 50,000 won per head instead of omakase restaurants as evidenced by the hike in sales and expansion of chains in one major buffet brand that now runs more than 120 stores nationwide and saw 500 billion won in sales last year.
With further inflation expected, maybe not the best of news for the Japanese restaurants that are serving omakase experiences to consumers. But Dan, to our final story, what is it?
Well, South Korean musical actress Ivy is set to make her Broadway debut. She plays Roxy Hart, the main character for the U.S. production of Chicago.
So some entertainment news and part of a trend of more K-stars going abroad. Dan, can you give us the details about how Ivy was cast in the first place for this big role and the upcoming production?
Sure thing. Korea Sensi Company said Wednesday that the K-pop singer turned musical actress got the invitation to audition for the role by the U.S. producers of the musical a year ago after going through a grueling process that involved sending multiple videotape audition clips over a period of a year. She finally got the nod. She will play Roxy Hart from August 17th to September 6th at the Ambassador Theater in New York.
This is certainly a huge career move for Ivy, certainly in a positive direction. Dan, could you explain how significant this accomplishment is for Ivy and Korea's musical industry as a whole?
Well, it's rare for Korean actresses to land a major role in a major U.S. musical production such as Chicago, much less the main leading role. Chicago is one of the longest-running American musicals in Broadway history that bagged 6 Tony Awards in 1997. For Ivy, the chance to reprise her role in the Broadway stage is extra special. As the 43-year-old debuted as Roxy Hart in the Korean licensed production of Chicago in 2012, which helped solidify her footing in the industry after making a very difficult transition from K-pop to musical theaters in early 2010s. She reprised her role across six seasons, too, through 2024, performing nearly 600 times, so she had ample practice.
I would love to learn more about how she prepared and what her mindset is actually as she gets ready to make this huge leap forward. Did Ivy have anything to say about that?
Yes, she did. She said she is honored and extremely thrilled to reprise her first leading role on the Broadway stage, and that she is very mindful, too, of the fact that she will be not just another performer on stage, but one that is representing South Korea. Chicago, the jazz-infused musical that centers around two women who chase fame amid scandal and crime, celebrates its 30th anniversary in Broadway this year, so all the more special of an experience or a team-up this is between Ivy and the U.S. musical production.
Best of luck to Ivy, but that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, I'm violinist Randall Boosby, and you are listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
Time now for the Korea Book Club, our weekly segment where we dive into the world of Korean literature and books, exploring works either in Korean or English translations. Joining us this week, we welcome back writer John A. Riley. John, hello, and thank you for joining us.
Hello, thanks for having me on the show again.
So what book do you have for us this time?
So this week's book is If We Cannot Go at the Speed of Light by Kim Cho-yeop. And that was originally published as Uriga Bichwe Sokdoro Galsu Opdamion, and it's been translated into English by Anton He.
The title sounds very profound, and I loved your Korean, the book's name, Uriga Bichwe Sokdoro Galsu Opdamion. And the author is Kim Cho-yeop, who's someone whose popularity has been growing in Korea for the past few years, and someone our listeners might have heard of before. John, what can you tell us about her?
So if listeners can remember back as far back as December, Korea 24, the panel of book critics, the producers of the show, we selected Kim Cho-yeop as the writer to watch out for in 2026. So she's a science fiction writer who's been credited with bringing Korean science fiction into the mainstream. And I love her for that. And she was born in Ulsan in 1993 into what sounds like a very artistic family. Her mother's a writer, her father's a musician, but she went into science. She went to Pohang's University of Science and Technology, where she obtained a degree in chemistry and then a master's in biochemistry. And I believe she's still there, but teaching classes in literature now. So she debuted in 2017, and she won the grand and runner-up prizes at the 2017 Korean Science Fiction Awards. Her work's been published in English before in Clark's World, which is a magazine where up-and-coming science fiction writers often appear. And If We Cannot Go at the Speed of Light is massive. It sold more than 400,000 copies in Korea. It's already been translated into Japanese and Mandarin, and now we've got the English translation too.
You've talked about Korean science fiction on the show before and how it seems to be taking off as a literary genre. John, so what's Kim's specific take on this theme?
All right. So one quote from her that really, really made me curious about her work, and it's quite a simple quote, but when you read the book, you kind of see it on a few levels. She said, "Dopamine is Netflix's realm, and I craft deep reads." And along with that deep read, she's also been described as a writer who deals with discrimination. Discrimination against women, against migrants, against people with disabilities. And I think that can sound as if her work's going to be kind of quite heavy, maybe a bit of a lecture, very serious, perhaps not very fun or exciting, but she has got this accessibility as well, this kind of lightness of touch to her work. And you don't get bogged down in all this techno babble like you do in some science fiction. And you certainly don't get bashed over the head, even though those messages I mentioned are there. So people and their real desires and their dilemmas are at the heart of this these stories. And the people in it, they're often quite lonely and vulnerable. But at the same time, this is obviously someone hugely kind of intellectual and academic. I thought of Fictions by Jorge Luis Borges a few times while reading it too.
Kim Choi-up is a scientist by training, but she's also wrapped in the body and DNA of artists, which turns out to be a combination that produces digestible, entertaining science fiction, as John is explaining right now. But with If We Cannot Go at the Speed of Light being a short story collection, since we can't summarize all of them, John, could you describe a couple of your favorites to give listeners a feel for this collection?
Yeah, so there's seven stories in this collection, and there's a brief afterword from Kim as well. But one of my favorite stories here is called Archival Loss, and that takes place in a future where when people die, they can be uploaded to a kind of library where they continue in a sort of afterlife, almost like the chatbots that are so popular at the moment. And at the start of the story, Ji-min is really upset to learn that the library's lost her mother. And the story deals with her attempts to navigate the bureaucracies of the library to try and find her mother because there's some unfinished emotional business that she needs to deal with. And I'm always saying, I think I've said on the show before, about how science fiction doesn't mean kind of little green men on alien planets. But then along comes Kim's story, Spectrum, which features exactly that, but really, really so well. So in this story, Heejin's marooned on an alien world, and she meets a creature which she christens Louie, a name that's kind of based on the sound that this creature makes. And they don't have a language in common, but they find a way to communicate, and they soon become friends. But then Louie dies, and then another Louie shows up who just seems to know and understand everything that the previous Louie knew. And Heejin's really curious to know how this is possible. So I could go on about every single story in this collection, but those are the two main ones, I think.
I suspect some of our listeners might be eager to meet Louie too, but what are some of the themes that Kim is exploring through these stories?
So there's so many themes in this book, and I think the idea of being uploaded and having some kind of virtual afterlife, that's quite a well-worn one in science fiction. You'll find it as far back as 70s Doctor Who episodes that have wonky special effects, maybe even earlier than that. But what makes this story really interesting is that the library didn't kind of like delete Ji-min's mother. they just lost her. The data still exists and she's milling around in their system somewhere. She's been kind of dispersed into it. So the story is speaking to all those philosophical debates about kind of like what we are. Is there some central self? Is there a soul, if you want to call it that? Or are we this collection of dispersed functions that create an illusion of a self? And the story links back to that Netflix quote that I mentioned as well, because when everything becomes digital and streamed and so on, there's much less emphasis on material culture and objects. Jimin doesn't have that kind of shoebox full of voids, handwritten notes, trinkets, things like that, that we often have of people. And once Jimin's mother is lost, that kind of seems to be it. But yeah, it's this dependence on these kind of large scale networks. And yeah, this story would definitely be interesting if it were about these metaphysical questions, but it's also a really moving story. There's grief, motherhood, reconciliation, all those themes in it too.
I can imagine. And what makes the story's spectrum stand out? As you mentioned, the first contact with aliens is a common theme in science fiction.
Yeah, so like all the stories in this collection, it's brilliantly written. It's been brilliantly translated. What makes it really interesting, I think, is the thematic similarity with Archival Loss. The question of whether this new Louis is the same person as the old Louis is kind of similar to Jimin's mother in this virtual state. And once again, the story has this emotional core. It's being narrated by the astronaut's granddaughter, and there's this sense of like the gulf between generations and the possibility of breaching it and communicating across it. So I really think if someone asked me, what do I think is a book that deals with the issues of 2026, this book would be it. There's artificial intelligence, there's living our lives online too much, there's kind of chasing our emotions through these massive tech networks, there's needing to pay to feel specific emotions. All these things feel really prophetic.
So then a question would be, if this book is so focused on contemporary issues, do you think it could go out of date too quickly? Because one example, I think, is that science fiction from the past that depicts intelligent life on Mars is very of its time now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really interesting to think about which books will be remembered in the future and which won't. As kind of in the book, Kim touches on this loss of physical books. Characters in the near future can kind of vaguely remember their grandparents having one or two books, for example. For me, it feels like the issues Kim deals with are going to become more prominent and that this is going to be called a prophetic book, I think. But even if they don't, even if this book does become dated in that way, life on Mars, things like that, I think it's still going to survive as a really strong work of literature, a record of this time period, what we were obsessed with, what our hopes and fears were. And yeah, there's also that really strong emotional core as well.
Well, obviously, emotions won't be disappearing in the future. But to our final question, which I think I know the answer to already, but John, would you recommend this book to our listeners?
Yeah, I absolutely would. So I go as far as to say this is one of my favorite Korean science fiction books. And as usual, I'd ask listeners who generally don't science fiction, try to put your prejudices aside. This is a book about what's going on in the world right now. It's also a varied collection. It's beautifully written. It's beautifully translated. And Kim has also written a full-length novel called Greenhouse at the End of the World, and that's coming out in an English translation soon. I absolutely can't wait for it.
Well, I will be looking forward to that book as well. Thank you, John, for all the stuff today.
Thank you so much. Bye.
And that's it for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back tomorrow. Again, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Kong, KBS World Radio, and KBS World Radio On Air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Did you enjoy this segment? You can discover more segments like this throughout the week on Korea 24. On Monday, we bring you news from the world of sport around the peninsula. Are you a fan of K-pop? Then be sure to join us on Tuesday to get the latest in the entertainment and K-pop world. For all the bookworms out there, tune in on Wednesday for Korea Book Club, where our literary critic helps us unpack works by Korean authors or written on Korea. Join us on an adventure every Thursday as we take a look at Korea's hidden gems with Explore Korea. And on Friday, listen to what our film critics have to say about the latest movie releases from both home and abroad. We have all that you need, all in one place, on Korea 24.